Command Module Pilot Al Worden, you're going to be very busy on Apollo 15. You have more to do than any other Command Module Pilot has ever done on one of the lunar landing flights, I think, Al. We want to talk to you about that a little later. First, tell us a little about who this man Al Worden is. Where do you come from originally? What part of the country?
All right, I grew up in a small town in Michigan. Actually, I thought it was a very large town at the time, but I guess the older I get, the smaller the town seems. Lived outside of the town, and I grew up on a farm.
Where'd you go to school?
Well, as a matter of fact, I went to one of the few one-room country schools that were in existence at the time. I started in that school the very first year that I ever went to school and left it for a few years when we moved into town, and then returned to that school and finished the 7th and 8th grades there in that school. There were 8 grades in the school, and we had a total of 32 students. Mm-hmm. So it was really a kind of backwoods schoolhouse that we had.
I guess aviation was a little distant
and,
at that point.
Well, it was, as a matter of fact. That just sort of gives you an indication of how fast things have progressed in this country, I guess.
Mm-hmm. From how old are you now, may I ask?
39
for our
now.
Listeners.
All
39. Right, you're a 39-year-old pilot.
Right.
And what was your experience in flying? How'd you get into aviation before you became an astronaut?
Well, I got into aviation because when I graduated from the military academy in 1955, I elected to go into the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And in conjunction with that,
you went
passed
to West
the
Point,
physical.
The military
That's
academy.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In conjunction with that, of course, once you elect to go into the Air Force, you automatically go into pilot training unless there's some physical reason that you can't. So I went to pilot training, and I hadn't really considered the flying part of it as my major goal. I liked the technology that the Air Force offered, and I liked the progressive outlook that I saw in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to flying school and spent several years flying in a fighter squadron in Washington, D.C., and along about that time, 58 and 59 and 60, the space program was getting started. And, of course, being stationed in Washington, which was the center of all the activity at the time, got interested in it, decided to go back to college, and did, and went back to the University of Michigan in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I graduated from the University of Michigan, I applied for the test pilot school, was accepted to go to Farnborough in England, and spent the year of 1964 in Farnborough.
Then when were you selected as an astronaut?
I was selected in 1966, and we reported in here in May of 1966.
What have you been working on up to this time, up to the assignment on the prime crew of Apollo 15?
Well, I guess I'd say I've gone through a kind of standard progression in the office. After the initial 6 months of ground school-type training that each of the new astronauts receives when he first arrives, I was assigned a support crew, on the support crew for Apollo 9, and I worked in that function for a couple of years until we got Apollo 9 going.
And that was supporting Dave Scott and
That was
Jim
supporting
McDivitt
Dave
and
Scott
Schweikart
and
then, yeah.
Jim McDivitt and Rusty Schweikart.
Mm-hmm.
After that, then Dave and I and Jim teamed up on the backup crew for Apollo 12.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. I've kind of worked with the same with the same group of fellows ever since I've been here. I've worked with Dave since about middle 1966 in one form or another. And, of course, Dick Gordon's the same way. He's our backup commander. The three of us have worked together since about the middle of 1966. So that's about 4 years now that we've worked together, 5 years.
Thanks very much, Command Module Pilot Al Worden. Al, after translunar injection, then the fun begins, then the science begins, right?
Right.
What all will you be doing first during the coast to the moon, then after you get into lunar orbit, up there in the command module? You have a real pack of equipment with you this time on Apollo 15.
Yes, that's true, Rhett. There won't be much activity surrounding the scientific instrument module until we get into lunar orbit, because we have the external door still installed at that time. Just prior to the lunar orbit insertion maneuver, we will jettison that door and expose all the experiments that we have in the sim bay.
Mm-hmm. The sim bay. We're going
right.
to hear that
the,
phrase.
The sim
an awful
bay,
lot,
and you'll be hearing a lot about that. Stands for Scientific Instrument Module, and it's one section of the service module, which is the maneuvering module behind the command module. It's the cylinder behind the command module.
Right. I think all our listeners can get that well in mind now.
In one bay there has a door which is jettisonable, and we jettison that door just prior to the lunar orbit insertion burn, exposing the instruments. And once we get into lunar orbit, then we start operating those experiments.
Is there no danger of contaminating the equipment before that burn?
Not before that burn, no. As a matter of fact, we've considered the problem of the contamination and elected to install additional covers over the instruments, which were beneath or underneath the jettisonable door. Mm-hmm. So each of the experiments has its own individual contamination cover. Mm-hmm. Contamination we can get from several sources. The reaction control system, which we use to maintain attitude, has a product. When the fuel's burned, there is a product, just like the exhaust out of a car. And these products can get into the sim bay and coat some of the instruments in the sim bay.
But you're not really worried about the big engine at that point.
No, we're not worried about the big engine at all, because it's behind, and any time it's burning, we're accelerating, which mm-hmm. means that we're flying away from any contamination that big engine produces.
Then what will you do in lunar orbit then before the LEM separates and goes down to the surface? Any particular photographic or measurement
tasks? Yes, as a matter of fact, one of the very first things we want to do when we get into lunar orbit is take some pictures of the lunar surface. And the reason we do that as early as we can is that the moon, obviously rotating around the Earth, rotates in such a way that the sun that's shining on the moon, the dawn and dusk, or terminators, if you will, rotate around the moon, and of course rotate completely around the moon once in the 28 days. Everything is changing, and the so-called far side terminator on the backside of the moon rotates towards the Earth in such a way that if we don't take a picture on the first or the second revolution, and then we're going to miss some of the lighted surface of the moon. So mm-hmm. we want to get some of those early pictures of the terminator if we can.
You're getting close to something else I wanted to get you to explain too, and that is that your orbit will be at such an inclination, this 26 degrees, is it?
That's correct.
To the north, mm-hmm. you'll be swinging farther north than any of our manned spacecraft have before. Therefore, with each revolution, I want our listeners to understand, you will be going over a different part of the moon instead of repeating your coverage of the same part. This is the essence of what you're going to be able to do with photography.
That's correct. And we're going to photograph some areas of the moon that have never really been photographed well up to now.
Really? Then you want to make the most of every revolution the whole time you're there, don't
you? That's exactly right. And we've gone to great lengths to schedule the photographic passes across the lighted side of the moon so that we get complete coverage of the surface under our trajectory for the complete flight. And that's one reason that we take the earliest pictures of the far side terminator and the latest pictures of the near side terminator just prior to returning home.
Mm-hmm.
The surface of the moon that we cover, because of the inclination, is considerably more than anything we've done before.
How much of the moon do you expect to get in the whole time you're
there? Well, we expect to take pictures of up to about 10% of the moon's surface.
Of the overall moon's surface,
that's correct. And that's all, of course, on the lighted side, or mostly on the side that faces the Earth. We're particularly interested in some areas where our lunar orbit photography has not been that good, and we want some detailed photographs of those particular areas, like Mare Serenitatis and Mare Crisium and Mare Tranquillitatis. Some of those areas were not photographed that well with lunar orbit, and we want to get those pictures.
Mm-hmm. We'll be talking more about the Command Service Module Science with Al Worden, Command Module Pilot for Apollo 15. Al, tell us what is in this SIM bay, this Scientific Instrument Module. Photography and sensors, right?
Yes, that's correct. The photography, the cameras themselves, are probably the largest pieces of equipment that we have in the sim bay.
One of those cameras is bigger than you are.
One of those cameras weighs 350 pounds, that's true, and it's a rather large instrument. It has to be large because the film is large. We have large film in there because we want to take very high resolution pictures, and that requires large film.
Well, this is going to be one of the most exciting returns from this mission.
Oh, absolutely.
This very high resolution photographer from this big camera you'll be operating and also going outside to take the film out.
In terms of what we see, the tangible things that we see after the flight, the photography is probably the most fantastic thing that we're doing. The large camera, for instance, will be able to see objects down to about 4 feet, four to five feet, something like that, which is just a little bit over a meter, about a meter and a half resolution with that large camera. And in fact, it's so good that we expect to be able to take pictures of the rover tracks after each EVA so that I can tell Dave and Jim where they've been.
And you're doing this from lunar orbit some...
60 miles away.
Some 30, let's see, some 80, 90 kilometers up.
That's true. It's a 100 kilometer orbit.
100 kilometer
right.
orbit, all right. Thank you for that translation. You do it roughly in real time here.
I get a little bit confused between kilometers and miles at times, but it turns out to be about 100 kilometers.
This is something that's quite frustrating to us here in the United States. We use the English system, and then so many of our listeners right there listening to us right now, they're normally used to interpreting in the metric system, so we have to try to translate it all for them.
Yes, and you know that's an interesting thing about the program. We're sort of in between the English system and the metric system.
I think by the end of the Apollo program, we'll be talking in meters?
Well, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. As a matter of fact, you know, the rover is calibrated in kilometers per hour. And they do everything on the surface in terms of kilometers. We talk orbits in terms of kilometers. We talk velocities in terms of feet per second. So there's a mixture of the two measuring systems. But I think we're getting closer to a metric system all the time.
Other than the big panoramic camera that we've discussed, there's a mapping camera, a smaller type.
Yes, the mapping camera is a very sophisticated camera. It doesn't take pictures of the resolution of the pan camera, but it does have a grid over which the picture is taken, which is a very accurate grid used for mapping. This grid, for instance, will allow us to take one complete pass over the moon surface, the lighted portion, 180 degrees of the moon surface, and map that area to within about 100 meters from the beginning of the pass to the end of the pass. To allow us to do that, there are a couple of other things associated with a mapping camera that are used by the cartographers in doing this kind of mapping, and one is the laser altimeter. That's built right into the body of the camera, and it takes a reading of the altitude in the center of the picture when the picture is taken. In every 20 seconds, we take a picture, and the laser altimeter fires, records the altitude within 2 meters
on the
center
film?
Of the film, or on the film, and that altitude is in the center of the film. In other words, it's taken in the center of the picture. And then to correlate the altitude and the picture and the attitude of the spacecraft, since the attitude at which we take the picture is very important to the cartographers. In other words, if you took a picture looking 20 degrees ahead of your spacecraft, then that altitude obviously is not the same as it would be if you took one looking directly down.
Then with the laser altimeter, this will allow the map makers to very accurately chart out altitudes.
Not only chart out horizontal terrain. Displacement and terrain, but to chart the altitude as well. To give us this attitude information, there's another camera, which is associated with the mapping camera, that takes a picture 90 degrees looking out into space of the star field, and they can. This also is a very accurate camera.
Gives you navigation.
And they can look at the stars, and then they can transform that into the attitude of the mapping camera when it took the picture.
And then, how about the sensors down at the bottom of the sim bay there?
The sensors in the lower end of the sim bay. We're getting into a different world here now with these sensors.
This is part of
this
the
is
package,
probably
though.
Scientifically, the instruments in the lower part of the sim bay are the most significant thing on the flight. They will allow us, we hope, eventually, to map completely any surface or object, planet, if you will, without actually going to the surface. So they could be very significant for future flights.
What do these things do?
These sensors, there are a series of sensors that essentially map the surface of the moon, in this case, from the context of the materials that are there, the geology and the chemistry of the things that we see on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Heat reflectivity and chemical reflectivity.
Yes, well, that's right. It's a chemical radiation type measurement. For instance, the solar or the X-ray fluorescence experiment. Solar X-rays bombard the surface, and they knock electrons out of the atomic units that they see on the surface, and in the collapse of the atom to replace that electron, it gives off a characteristic X-ray. These characteristic X-rays can be seen some distance away with the type instrument that we're carrying.
This
and
is
they're characteristic
the
as
sensing.
To the element that was there. That's mm-hmm. correct. This is basic to remote sensing.
Mm-hmm.
All of the instruments are complementary in that respect. The gamma ray, the alpha particle, and the X-ray are all complementary. The information derived from the three of these instruments will be correlated and then mapped, or the surface will be mapped as to the matter, the content on the surface. And then along with that is a mass spectrometer from which we hope to gather some information about the atmosphere. So you see where this is leading us eventually. With these kind of instruments, and obviously with some increase in our technology in the future, we'll be able to go someplace, go into orbit around that object or planet, and from orbit, determine what's on the surface and what's in the atmosphere of that planet. If you wanted to go into orbit around Mars, for instance, do this kind of survey before you commit to landing. Mm-hmm. Find out what's there and what would be the best place to land.
Thanks very much, Al Worden, for telling us about this extremely interesting scientific instrument module, the SIMBAE, on the Command and Service Module, which is going to keep you very busy here.
Right.
Al Worden, Command Module Pilot, Apollo 15. Al, the small satellite you're going to release is expected to stay in lunar orbit for quite a while, hopefully for at least a year. What is it supposed to accomplish? That's part of your assignment, is to be in charge of that.
That's right. The sub-satellite, again, is a very sophisticated package which will be in lunar orbit by itself once we leave. And its primary function is to measure the particle field around the moon, in terms of the plasma flow, the cosmic radiation that it sees. It also measures the magnetic fields. It has a magnetometer associated with it, which will measure the magnetic fields around the moon. What we're attempting to do with the subsatellite is investigate the interaction between the atmospheres around the moon and the Earth in conjunction with the solar flux that we see every day. There is some interaction there where we feel that we understand most of this interaction, but we have never had a chance to map in detail that interaction with respect to the moon. And this really is in terms of very, very basic research as to what these bodies do when they're in orbit around one another, and how they react, and what their atmospheres are like, and how they affect each other.
Well, the Apollo program is just taking advantage of the fact that you had an adequate weight allowance this time on this mission in order to take this tag-along satellite and deposit it in a good, stable lunar orbit. That's the reason it's there this time, isn't it?
Well, it's maybe a little differently than the way you said it. The sub-satellite has always been a part of our flight, and it was designed into the basic flight right from the very start. When we first transferred or switched from the old series of command module to the J series and started talking about the SIMBAE, all of that increase in capacity of not only the command service module but of the lunar module was done so that we could carry things like the subsatellite.
That means then that Apollo 16 and 17 will also have a capacity for...
I'm not sure. They'll have the capacity, that's true. Whether they both carry subsatellites, I'm not sure at this point. Mm-hmm. 16 will carry one. I'm not sure about 17.
You release it just from inside the command module by actuating some spring mechanism.
That's true. It's just a switch inside, and the subsatellite is held in its container by spring, mm-hmm. Which is compressed and held compressed by a very small pyrotechnic device. When we throw the switch, the pyrotechnic device goes and the spring ejects the subsatellite.
And it's your job to get the command service module in a very refined and precise orbit before that, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. And in fact, that's one of the latest changes in our flight plan as such. We had originally intended to eject the subsatellite early in lunar orbit. In fact, at about the same time they were landing on the surface, we were going to get the subsatellite out into orbit by itself. It turned out that that particular orbit that I was in at the time was not a good orbit for the subsatellite, and it reduced its lifetime considerably because of the perturbations of the moon's gravitational field. So we elected to keep the subsatellite during all of the lunar orbit activity, then just prior to doing a trans-Earth insertion burn, shape our orbit such, do a shaping maneuver such, that we could guarantee at least a year on the subsatellite. So that's where it is in the flight plan right now.
We'll be listening for that particular maneuver, and we hope it'll last for a year and give us some very accurate information about the moon and particularly those mascons and so forth.
Right, we're looking forward to that kind of information.
Thanks, Al. On your way home, Al, you've got to sort of wrap up the sim bay package, and you're the man who's going to go outside in your pressurized spacesuit, go EVA as it's called, and bring it in. Tell us about that assignment and sort of a chronology of what you'll do.
Okay, Rhett, the EVA has one major goal, and that is to recover the film that's been exposed in the panoramic camera and in the mapping camera.
Some big cassettes.
There are some very large cassettes. The panoramic camera, for instance, is roughly 85 pounds. And I would say the cassette is about 5 inches in thickness and about 15 or 16 inches in diameter.
It's almost a half a meter wide.
Right. It's a very large size object to be carrying and moving around.
Mm-hmm. Some big film for those very accurate pictures.
That's correct. The high-resolution pictures. It's 4 or 5-inch film very tightly reeled onto this cassette. 85 pounds worth. The mapping camera is much smaller because the mapping camera is a 70-millimeter camera, uses that size film. There's also, on that cassette, an additional reel of film which is used in the Stellar camera, and that's 35-millimeter film. The sequence of the EVA is that we all three get into our pressure suits. I get onto a separate oxygen umbilical for my suit, since it has to be a long one.
You'll be on an umbilical from inside.
That's correct.
With the emergency pack?
That's right. I'll be on an umbilical that's connected to the oxygen system inside the command module, and I'll carry an oxygen purge system or backup oxygen supply on my back. Open the hatch. Go down the handrails on the side of the command module, which are placed there just for this reason.
Feel your way down.
Feel my way down. Get into the sim bay, into the foot restraints, pull the contamination covers off of the pan camera and the mapping camera, tether myself to those two cassettes, and bring them back in. It's a very simple thing.
About how long do you expect to be outside?
Well, I expect the operation will take somewhere between 15 and 20 minutes after we open the hatch. And, of course, the first thing we do after we open the hatch is we put the TV camera on the hatch to watch the whole exercise. So that should be something rather interesting for everybody. We'll be about 40,000 miles out from the moon.
Mm-hmm.
It's an EVA, which is I don't know how you would say it, but it's further away in deep space than any EVA we've ever done, except for being on the lunar surface.
We'll all be watching.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Command Module Pilot Al Worden.